All right. If you're here, you want to know about numbers and statistics that mislead and those that don't. If that's not what you're here for, you're in the wrong room, and this airplane is going to Cincinnati. So, I'm Seth Borenstein, with AP, a science writer with AP. Let me introduce to you our panel first. Actually, before we even do that, I'll start class with music, which you can't hear, because I forgot that part. Never mind.
The speaker.
Some of you might recognize MythBusters. It's their music, and that's the point of this. We are going to. You can't hear this music.
Use the mic.
It's okay. You wouldn't recognize it anyways. But this is all about, going to be about busting some of the myths and how to figure out when statistics are being misused and when they're being used and how to tell the difference. So to do this, we have a distinguished panel to look at. Now you hear that, right? Okay.
Tornado sirens.
All right. Any of you were at Riley Dunlap's session? It was quite impressive. Okay, let's get this. So our first speaker is Robert Mason. He's a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's chief of the USGS Office of Surface Water, and he supports, the USGS Surface Water Data Collection and Science Activities, especially those related to the characterization and modeling of floods and droughts, which means he has a very newsy presentation, although it's September 8th, but you know, we do have some floods rather recently, as you see. And then next to Robert, we have Derek Deke Arndt. Don't call him Derek in print. He's a native Oklahoman, so this is homecoming for him. He is the monitoring chief at NOAA's National Center for Environmental Information. Do not call it National Climate Data Center, like Dr. Sullivan did this morning. And you can read his blogs at climate.gov. And the latest one, I believe, is about El Nino and how El Nino is like a bad bartender. Or is it a good bartender? I don't remember if it's...
There's no bad bartender.
It's an erratic bartender.
Erratic, thank you.
And our final panelist, who actually won't be our final panelist, so he'll be our middle panelist, is Kevin Klossel. He's director of the Oklahoma Climatological Survey. He is the state climatologist, right?
No,
the survey. That's, I'm sorry. That's,
yeah, Gary's that's, next door.
Gary's next door. Sorry about that. That's... he is also the OU office. He's a professor of atmospheric and geographic sciences here at University of Oklahoma. He is the university meteorologist for the OU Office of Emergency Preparedness, you know, things like tornadoes. So since we didn't have our music work, let's just go right to Robert and see if that microphone works.
Good morning. Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for joining us here this afternoon.
So
I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey, as Steph was saying. The mission of the survey is to describe and understand the Earth, provide information so that people can live better and safer. We do that in part through the operations of a lot of our observation networks. The biggest by far of those is the stream gauging network. That network is a network that allows us to monitor floods and droughts. And because of the recent flooding that we've had, I thought it might be useful for us to take some time out to look at some flood statistics and talk about how we prepare those and what they mean. So the title is Talking About Flood Statistics with Examples from South Carolina. And it's 1,000 years of water or 100 feet of time. And I hope you catch that joke. So this is the an image of the USGS stream gauging network. To your top left there is an image that shows all of the gauging stations, some 8,100 gauging stations. And this map is colored so that you can see wet or dry for this time of year, that is for this day. We operate these for a variety of people. They are used by the National Weather Service for doing flood forecasts, by the Corps of Engineers for operating dams, by 1,001 different agencies for design of different kinds of structures around the country and their operation. Water quality monitoring, things of that nature get done through this network. There are about, I was saying, 8,100 gauging stations. Of those, there's a fairly short number, small number that are actually long-term records. Only 284 of our gauging stations have records that exceed 100 years. That's something that we're working on, but it has some implications for what I'm about to say about other things. So I thought I'd give you a quick check sheet here to think about some of the statistics that we'll be you'll be encountering when you talk about floods. And one piece of advice to begin up front, and that is to be skeptical about what it is that you're being told. So the kinds of things that I would ask when people tell me what the rarity or the severity of a flood is to ask if I could see their data. Did they collect data? Is the data available to us? Is the data accessible and can we access it? How long? What's the length of record for the data? Does it occur for 10 years or 100 years? And it really does make a big difference. When I look at the data that I might see, I would ask myself, are there any floods that are higher than the flood of interest? This particular flood, October of 2015, is the flood of interest, and is there something higher or smaller? And then is the current flood a new record, which is sort of saying the same thing as the previous bullet, but from a slightly different perspective? Are there any data that were excluded from the analysis that might be useful? And then lastly, are there basin characteristics that we might take into account? Are we looking at an urban site? Are we looking at a big site? Are we looking at a regulated, that is to say, a site on which there's a dam? So people banish about things like recurrence intervals, and that's what I'm going to be sort of drilling in on. To your top left here, I guess I have a cursor, maybe? Okay, I've got it right here, I think. So to your top left is a hydrograph. This is what comes in from the stream gauges. And you can see the water rising and topping out and then diminishing. This red dot here is where we're making a discharge measurement. I should have explained that earlier, but that's what this guy is doing here. He is standing on a bridge. There is a device here that he's going to tow across the stream. As he does that, it will tell him what the discharge is. We use that to correct this data that are coming in from the stream gauges themselves. So the stream gauges provide us a time series of data. And in this case, the maximum flow was around 8,600 CFS. This occurred on October 5th, just last week. And what I'm going to show you is just what does that peak means in terms of its rarity. So one thing we do with the USGS, whoops, sorry. Back. Is that it? Right there, okay. Sorry. So one of the things we do here is we look at these peaks and we compile them for each year of the record. So in this case, on the bottom right, you see that there is a record of peak flows that have occurred all through time, beginning from 1928, when this record started, to 2015, this past week. And you'll see here that I have transferred the 8,600 CFS from this peak up here onto this graph. And the important point is that there are a couple peaks that are higher than this particular one here. So that tells me something right away. This is a fairly rare flood. It's a big flood. In this case, about the third highest of the period of record. But the period of record is some 80 years long. It's not 100 years, it's not 500 years. And so I would be hard-pressed to say that that's a particularly rare event. Down here, by the way, before I get away from it, is the median flow for the gauge. And that's really just a very small low flow, and I'll explain why that's important in a moment. But I want you to notice that there's a big difference between these flood flows and this down here. And actually, I probably have overextended that line a little up to the tie-in. This is the flood frequency diagram that resulted from analysis of those data you just saw. So what you see over here are the annual peaks, the flows, the discharges. And over here is the probability. That is, on this axis, is the probability of the flood. And through the data, these little dots here are the same data as what you were just seeing, the little blue dots. We fitted the best fit using some statistical analysis. In this case, this is how it is that engineers compute a flood frequency distribution, and that's exactly what you're looking at here. That red dot, or red line rather, is again the 8,600 CFS that was recorded on October 5th. And the point is, in order to figure out how rare this event might be, you're going to come over to this axis, read across, and read down. And you'll see that it's something on the order of a 2% chance flood. A 2% chance flood is something that's, in layman's terms, the 50-year flood. And I'm sure you've heard that we don't use that term quite so often anymore, mostly because it seems to mislead people into thinking that a flood occurs every once in a 50 years. And that certainly isn't the case. I'll show you in a moment some examples of why that isn't. Down here is let's go to this. So that was not a particularly rare flood, a 25, 50-year event. It's a big, big deal, and it floods homes, and it goes over bridges, and it washes away schools and things like that. But it is not something that is terribly rare. In this case, is a Black River at King's Tree. This is another site. The site's located closer to the coast and a little closer to the area where there's more rainfall occurring. And you see again, here's the trace from the gauging station. We had a peak of 86,000 CFS, cubic feet per second. on October 4th, that's showing up right up here, right next to where that discharge measurement is, and I plotted, hit it again, and we plotted the data on here, and you'll see that the red line ain't there. The red line is not on the graph. The red line is, in fact, up here. This is a new record, and the flow went over and above the record that we had. So it's something unusual. It's something different. It was a big deal. This is the flood frequency analysis that came out of it. And again, in this case, this in engineering units, I apologize for the scale there, but this is the same flow, 80,000 CFS, and it's plotted across here. And again, if you wanted to figure out what the recurrence interval is, you'd come across to where this red line intersects. Only the red line doesn't, because it's a new value. It's something different. What's more, you haven't explained to you what the blue lines are. I get my cursor back. There it is. So this is a confidence interval. So this tells us something about the confidence we have in this line. And when we look at that, it gives us some assurance that the line is correct, and we get some idea that as you get higher in the flows, higher into rarity, that the confidence interval spread. We have less confidence in bigger numbers, and that should resonate with you all. It makes a lot of sense. There are other places where we do this, and how am I doing on time? Okay. So this is another site. This particular site is the Congaree River at Columbia. This site is located in the middle of the state. It drains much of this area here. It is not, this area was not as impacted by the rainfall as the down on the coast sites were. But this is a hydrograph. You also notice that there's pretty interesting patterns here. That's because there's a dam upstream. There's a hydroelectric power plant that releases water, and that signature is reflected in that particular graph. It turns out that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers built a dam here in 1930, and they used that dam to sort of throttle back the flooding. So on one side, before the dam was built, you have huge floods. On the other side, you have a lot less floods. This, again, is the 185 CFS that occurred associated with this peak up here. And you can get some idea right away that it's the biggest thing we've had in a while, but it's not the biggest by far. I mean, there's some that occurred prior to the dam that are much higher, and also after the dam, there's some that are fairly large. So I'm not going to do the flood frequency, but I wanted to just speak briefly about the evidence of climate change that people often draw from this sort of data. On the left is an evaluation of the flood peaks that have occurred for a number of gauging stations where we have natural flow. 740 sites. The sites are scattered around the country. Up arrows mean there's some trend toward increasing the stream flow or the peak flows. Down arrows means there's some trend toward decreasing. What you guys are probably not seeing, and I want to draw it to your attention, are the little dots that are interspersed all around that map. And those are places where we had no trend up or down, nothing statistically significant. I won't talk about trying to infer significance from something that's insignificant, but it is significant for you to hear that, okay? So at any rate, these are an analysis of annual peaks. The other graph over here are analysis of the median flows. I was showing you that before. Oops, back here. Down here is the median peak. And the point of this is, these are very small, low, everyday flows, the kind of flow that best typifies today. Not a flood, not a big event. But in that situation, we actually began to see a little bit more of a trend that seems to suggest that, trying to get my arrows here again, seems to suggest that there is an increasing trend, particularly for those flows that are in the northern part of the country, and a decreasing trend on those places that are, say, in the southwest. That's not unusual. It's sort of consistent with what we are hearing from the climate change community and the meteorological community. What's important for you to hear here is that these are not the kinds of flows on the right that are of engineering significance. We don't really use those in designing a dam. We don't use those in designing a bridge. They don't come into play in flood frequency analysis or insurance rates, those sorts of things. These flows on the left do. These over here are the kinds of flows that affect people who have more of a day-to-day concern. Farmers, people who, not necessarily depending on the water, I'm not trying to say they depend on the river, but they're depending on the availability of water day in and day out. And I think I'll close it with that.
Oh, good. Thank you. You can move this over because I
unplugged
it.
All right.
So maybe there. Okay, Kevin, now let's talk. Let's go from water to air.
Yeah, I'm going to take a slightly...
I have to stand up, sorry. I'm going to take an opportunity to use my 5 minutes to apologize. And one of the things about a 5-minute apology is that as a scientist, we tend to put folks that are covering science stories at a disadvantage. So for today's panel, I'm going to take a slightly bigger picture view of the kinds of things that we do to you that maybe you don't even know that you're doing. And so we are going to talk a little bit about illustration obfuscation as well as the ability to tell the difference. And I'm going to start with something you have in your hands, and that's the program. Get out your program. Is there anything wrong with the graphics that you see in the program or on the program, the fun graphics on the front, or if you flip open the first page and there's all that pretty frontal boundary business? By the way, I do everything in audience participation mode. Yes. The fronts don't go that way, do they? Not only that, but if we are going to be meteorologically providing you with fronts with cold air, what color are those fronts? They're blue. They're not red, and they're certainly not pointed the other direction, like to the north, because a cold front with those arrows indicate the motion of cold air. And so this would be cold air coming from the south as warm air is coming from the north, which means that on the one side of the front above, it would have to be warm, but at the same time, with the front to the top, it would have to be cold, which means the air in between those two fronts would have to be cold and warm at the same time. Is that realistic? No. One of the problems that we have in science is sometimes we think about graphics and we think about the message that we're communicating, but in the interest of being cool and pretty and fun and graphical, we lose the scientific context, or we lose completely the scientific meaning. And your graphics, unfortunately, in your program is an example of that. So what we've done, and I find my students, I know you're not supposed to do this in an academic area, but whenever they do something like that, if they obfuscate a picture, a figure, I fine them a dollar. I am inviting each of you, if you have Facebook, to join the That's a Dollar Facebook page, where my students and I go around and other people around the country and find figures that are misleading, that obfuscate, and we point them out. For each one that's found, we donate a dollar to the Red Cross. So at the end of the year, we add them all up. They get a donation to the Red Cross. I'm inviting you to participate because there are some gems on this site. For example, Hurricane Joaquin recently apparently was sensed from space with the ultimate Doppler. Thousands of miles from Miami to San Juan across a satellite image which is called Ultimate Doppler. You guys know that that's not real, right? You know that there's no such thing as an ultimate Doppler that has that kind of domain. So the kinds of things that we see that people are, you know, sort of gaining their education from are in most instances just absolutely wrong. For example, why are you laughing at him? That's not very nice. Does anybody recognize that animal? Punxsutawney Phil. What does that animal do? Predicts what? Spring? The end of winter? Seriously? Really? Okay, well, I've learned something today then, because I thought he was an indicator for stock market performance. Because the stock market performance metrics for Punxsutawney Phil are more robust statistically than anything having to do with seasonal weather or climate. You guys didn't know this? You could take that figure and turn your investment portfolio into a massive win because of Punxsutawney Phil. You know, it's so bad that poor Deke here and his shop have to put out a disclaimer every year. Think about the intellectual capital that has to be invested because so many people take that rodent as a figure and say, I'm going to plan my activities accordingly. Winter, spring, whatever the case may be. So now poor Deke and his group have to write a statement that says, you know what, that thing's not really that accurate. And then it all comes out. I mean, everybody does this. News channels, etc., every year at the same time have to put out this, hey, you know what, that thing's really not right too much. So I have a question. This is the last thing I'll leave you with before I turn it over to Deke. Which graph illustrates the greater upward trend, the one on the right or the one on the left? Thank you. For those of you who said they're the same, because it's a trick question, good for you. It's the same data. So, yeah, it's different axes. So if somebody was paying attention to the headline that says upward trend, and I use the graphic on the right, how are they going to rectify that upward trend in their head with what they see? Versus the one on the left, which I can make look as upward trend as I want, simply by changing the axes, not the data. These are the things that you have to be incredibly discriminating about as it pertains to figures, and I'm going to turn it over to Deke.
Thanks. All right, awesome.
Want me to put
the two? Seth has some stuff, yeah.
All right. Deke, you see that this is from Christopher Monckton of Brenchley. This is courtesy of Mark Morano, where, you know, people go for their climate obfuscation. So, but we've all seen this. If you write about climate, you've seen this graph over and over again. It gets tweeted all the time. Tell me, look, there has been no global warming for 18 years, 8 months.
Okay.
Can you explain that to me?
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's good to be back. We always look forward. We had another opportunity to meet in Oklahoma a few years ago, but the government kind of got in its own way, and I was unable to come. So I was really looking forward to being here in my native state and excited to kind of cut loose a little bit and not worry about the boss being around. And, and Seth sits me next to my old boss. So I'll try to keep it professional for Kevin. So, so this is one of several topics out there that have a mythology surrounding it, a meme or a theme where we hear this kind of constant drumbeat and stuff like this pops out of nowhere. So when Seth first called and asked, he asked for, I want to do a myth-busting kind of thing, and I called him back. He's like, oh, we can do satellites and models and data adjustments, and I went through this list of like 12 things that we could cover, and Seth said, no, I've interviewed you. Why don't you pick one? And so this was one that he suggested, actually.
Yes.
So to kind of unpack some of the issues surrounding this particular meme or myth, we'll kind of deep dive into it, and some of the, so first, this is satellite information as opposed to surface information. So this concept that the temperature has not risen gets thrown around and kind of compared to projections of surface temperature. And to further unpack that, so we at NOAA and several other groups around the world use in situ information, so station-based buoys, weather stations, ships around the world, to compare to surface-based data that's been collected since 1880, and that's the global surface temperature. So our shop kind of analyzes that every month, and we'll issue reports and statements related to that. This is the temperature not of the surface, but of the lower troposphere. And I know most of you are probably familiar with the structure of the atmosphere, but if you haven't been refreshed in a while, we live in a bowling ball in space, and it's got a thin layer of air around it that we call the atmosphere. And if we were to flatten out the atmosphere and go up, so we live on the surface, which would be the floor of this room. The atmosphere, if the ceiling would be the kind of so-called top of the atmosphere. The measurements that we are taking as the global surface temperature are taken down at the surface, down at the bottom of the atmosphere. This particular data, and it's very valuable data to have, happens to be remotely sensed from a satellite, many thousands of feet and miles into space. The ultimate Doppler satellite, thank you, yeah. But it's remotely sensed. It's divined from signals, from electromagnetic signals that come off the Earth. And moreover, it is not a measure of the surface, the temperature of the surface of the Earth, but it's a measure of the lowest 8,000 meters, which is about 26,000 feet, which happens to be more than half of the mass of the atmosphere. And one of the kind of true, or one of the big smoking guns from the data world about how climate change is driven by changes in greenhouse gas composition is that the lower atmosphere is warming while the upper atmosphere is cooling. It is one of the kind of smoking guns from the data world. It is difficult to warm the surface of the planet and cool the upper atmosphere without changing the composition of the atmosphere. the sun and other forces can't selectively heat different parts of the Earth atmosphere system. So one of the findings, one of the data findings, is that the lower part of the atmosphere is warming, the upper part of the atmosphere, particularly the stratosphere, is cooling. And this measurement happens to incorporate the entirety of the bottom half of the atmosphere and part of the atmosphere that's above the upper half of the atmosphere. So it would tend to make sense that the trends that we would see in this data would not have a strong a warming component. The other thing about this and kind of the theme that went along with the hiatus, and the hiatus was frankly a pretty substantial kind of piece of information that was running out there for a while, is that it was said to begin in 1998. And this is something you can always look out for and keep an eye on us and keep an eye on other folks that are presenting the same kind of information. Ask them why they selected, ask us why we selected a particular starting point. Why did we select a particular period of time to do an average? Why are we using the 20th century average and not the last 30 years? Those are important questions to ask, because if a scientific finding is robust, we should be able to defend our selections there immediately with a decent justification. And sometimes the justification may be, well, that's the standard period from the lens through which we look at a lot of data. But if you say 1998 seems kind of like a weird year to start measuring a trend, if you were to look at the surface temperature record, 1998 was a really warm year. It has since been eclipsed a few times, but it stands way up above its neighbors if you were going to do a graph of the temperature of the surface of the Earth. So that was a selection made to prove a point. It was you move that starting point a couple years in either direction, and the entire concept of a hiatus falls apart. So ask us. Ask us why we chose a starting point or a base period. That's an important, fundamental, foundational question. The other thing that I would add that's related to this hiatus case is the House of Cards meme, the House of Cards mythology. The notion that if one piece of information is somehow discredited or disproven, that the entire foundation and basis of all of this science falls apart. That is a courtroom tactic, but that is not a scientific tactic. Science is about a robust understanding of a phenomenon or many phenomena or a complex system from many different directions. So during the years that we had this so-called hiatus, which really didn't exist, and if it existed, it only existed in a special data set in which you would expect the chances of it existing to be more likely. During that time, we set multiple records for a lack of sea ice. We set multiple records for the ocean temperature. We set multiple records for sea level. We set multiple records for glacial loss. We set multiple records for the lack of snow cover across the Northern Hemisphere. So does this theme, even if it were true, would not change our fundamental understanding of the rest of the climate system and how these things are connected together. So be wary, both from scientists and from folks who may like to bash scientists, and when there's plenty of stuff you can knock about the science that we do. Be wary of claims that say this changes everything. It really doesn't. When we criticize each other in scientific papers, we're criticizing technical pieces, we're maybe criticizing or re-examining a piece of the total science. You know, if you were going to the OU Texas game tomorrow and I said, why don't you take this route? You know, it usually works for me, and you got stuck in a traffic jam. Would you say Decarn is a lying person? you know, he's terrible at driving. He can't drive. No, you wouldn't. You would hopefully not. you know, you would understand that, you know, there are situations in which there's counter evidence. There's going to be counter evidence in a complex system. Our lives are complex. The climate system is complex. We can, you know, my weight, even if the hiatus were true, I've been hanging out in a pretty bad neighborhood for quite a while. My weight has thankfully reached a hiatus. Doesn't mean I'm healthy, right? The doctor says, your weight's here, it should be here. And I say, well, my weight's been there for 15 years, so I don't have a problem. You know, it's a phony argument. Even if the hiatus were true, even if it were true of surface temperature, we're in a bad neighborhood. Even if it were true, we may not be going deeper in a bad neighborhood in surface temperature, but we're there. A flat rate is not a good place to be. The world is changing around us. Even if the temperature were to have stopped for 15 years, We're seeing some real consequences out there.
And of course it hasn't, because last year was the warmest year on record.
Right.
This year is you calculated more than 95% chance?
Yes, 97, I believe.
More than 97% chance that this year will break last year's record. And then with an El Nino, next year is more likely to break this year's record, right?
You didn't hear that from me.
Okay. Maybe.
It is a very likely scenario. If the El Nino continues to go strong, that we will threaten the record.
I'm going to take moderated prerogative and ask a few questions. But first, one for all three of you that Robert hinted at here. You were talking about the importance of 100-year data and showing us a few places with not 100-year data. So, for example, weather records in worldwide go back to 1895, right?
In the U.S., 95. For the world, 80.
Temperature. 1895 for the U.S., the world, 1880. Mm-hmm. Much of your data was going back to the 1920s.
And that particular set, yes.
Yeah. What number, as a rule of thumb for reporters, if you see a database less than X, don't use it? So in weather, and then in hydrology, what's that red line?
Sure. Do you want me to?
No, you're going to do weather.
Why don't you do weather, then we'll go
sure.
to hydrology.
So the what scientists would like to draw a statistically significant conclusion is around 30 samples. That's not necessarily a magic number, but it's a fairly magic number when you're rejecting a hypothesis. And I would kind of draw a fine line. There is a subtle but important distinction between these kind of assessments where you're trying to evaluate how unusual a certain datum is or how unusual a certain phenomenon is or where does a year's temperature rank among history, that is a process in the science world that we call assessment, and it is different than research. It is not, we're not disproving a hypothesis. We're not testing a hypothesis. We are taking data and drawing conclusions from it. So there's no magic number, but in order to, you know, kind of build statistical significance, especially when you're making claims like how unusual something is, at least a 30-member sample is typically kind of the baseline.
So that would be 30 years, right?
30 years if you're comparing years to years. 30 years is a good sample. 30 events, 30 selections from some phenomenon, yeah.
So then most of the flooding was okay, right? The flooding...
No. if you're comparing a mean to a mean, something like a 20 or 30 makes a lot of sense. Yeah. When you're comparing something like an extreme, particularly if you're trying to identify the extreme of that distribution, you're likely to need something more.
How much more?
And you need to span. It's not so much in some sense the length of the record. It's the experiences that you span, the experiences that you've had. You've had big floods. You've had little floods. Now you can start drawing inferences.
Okay, so, Kevin?
Yeah, the challenge here is that it's not the same for every parameter. So
right.
If you're looking at rainfall, that's going to be something different than temperature. And we've done this in Oklahoma at the climate survey, is we have a network that goes back to 1994, and so that's... Oh, sure.
We have a network here called the Oklahoma Mesonet that we're trying to determine whether we can use it as a climate signal for Oklahoma. It's only been here 20 years. But looking at that data in a comparative way, there's a tremendous body of work where scientists are trying to answer the question that's been posed quantitatively. What is that number? And what we're finding is that the optimal number is different for each parameter. So for floods, it's likely to be different than it is for temperature, is likely to be different for rainfall, et cetera. And we're still trying to gauge exactly what that magic number is of how much data is sufficient to tell a story. And of course, like Deke said, it depends upon the scale of the story. Are we talking weeks, seasons, years, et cetera?
Okay. And one more on similar, is it observational data quality? So in the back of the room, there's Harold Brooks, a tornado researcher. So if you looked just at tornado reports and don't do any factoring, they're going up in general, right, Harold? But, Harold, in almost every tornado, I'm sure you would say so, Kevin, right? That doesn't mean, it just means we're noticing it because there's more of us to see and we're getting better at this type of thing. We have smartphone cameras to take pictures and post them on YouTube. Hurricanes are the same way. when you go back further into the 1900s, you know, early 1900s, late 1800s, and that has been a problem with the debate over are we going to see, you know, are we seeing more or less major hurricanes? We don't know how much we had. So how does data quality affect this?
Right, so you made an important distinction, so when we're talking about tornadoes and hurricanes, those are things that we count, as opposed to things that we measure with instruments. And the way that those data evolve over time, when you look at it from a climate perspective, are very different. And I think I'll channel Harold, and he can please correct
That's
me when
scary.
I miss. But the, you know, the tornado record we've gotten since the, you know, mid-20th century, when we kind of start the modern tornado record, we've had several technological advancements. We've had Doppler radar, for one. We've had advances in forecasting, the knowledge, the advances in computing that help our modeling and forecasting. So we're much better at not only detecting tornadoes, but at anticipating and warning for them, and capturing evidence of them as well. So that has truly driven the increase in the number of tornadoes that we've seen. Harold and many of his colleagues will do things to help reduce this effect or mitigate for this effect by, say, only looking at the higher-end tornadoes or the tornado events that are a certain magnitude, because that's one way to, weed out, so to speak, and focus only on the tornadoes that we probably would have detected in 1952 using completely different tools than we do in 2014. Same with hurricanes. The satellite era, since the 60s and 70s, we're a lot better at catching hurricanes, because before then we had, ships out there, and they tend to try to avoid them. So those are two distinct phenomena, and it's one, and so that's another good thing to ask yourself or ask the scientist: is this something that we count, and how we observe this? How has it changed over time? Are we better than we used to be at this, or not?
Okay, and just in 1 minute before, so then this is my last question for you. No, actually for you, Deke, okay. Because you're the guys who, according to people like the false name Steve Goddard, who this is not his real name. You guys are cheating with the statistics. You've tinkered with the global weather statistics. Why is that cheating? Did you move everything up so it looks like more warming, or what did you do?
Yeah, so that's another one of the memes that we deal with, and the folks that I work with at NCEI in Asheville are wonderful people. Hasn't been a great decade to walk into a bar and say I'm a government scientist who's here to buy drinks. So truly wonderful people that I've worked with that have dealt with the kind of fallout from these kinds of claims. First of all, again, the House of Cards theme. Ohio State University won the national championship in football last year, but, they didn't.
They will do so again this year.
So they messed up a lot of plays last year. So singling out, single instances and saying, that play didn't go well for Ohio State, therefore they didn't win the national championship. It's a scaling thing. So a lot of times these arguments look at the adjustments we make, extrapolate from there, and say, therefore this is false. One thing, again, in the beware the House of Cards meme, the adjustments that we make in total, when you sum them all together, we make a lot of adjustments. The data needed to be corrected. There are stations out there that have moved around. They've moved around. They've been both documented and undocumented moves. We've changed instruments. We've had changes to the environment surrounding stations. But people have also dedicated careers into accounting for this. And when you look at the sum of all of our corrections, we actually reduce the trend. The line gets smaller. So if our motivation is to adjust our way into more warming, we're pushing the needle in the wrong direction. And it's because of the way we correct ocean data, which you don't hear a lot about, because we happen to be pushing the needle the other way in a very valid, regulated, and well-described in the literature kind of way.
So. Okay, that's great. Now it's time for questions. As usual, if you haven't heard this rule by now, you should have, but SEJ and working journalists first. That means you have a blue badge, sort of like this, and no speech making, please, and please identify yourself. So who wants to ask the first question? Come on. I usually ask the first question. Someone else has to do it now. I can ask more questions, but you guys have to ask something. You don't know all this yet.
Hi, I'm Bowman Cox with a publisher called Informa. My question is about this sort of spurious data, and you've explained to us how it's false, but for the people that believe in it, do those explanations work, and how do you approach it to educate them?
Thanks. So that's a constant challenge. I think we live in an era where people have the tools and the bandwidth to go seek out data that support their preformed opinions, so it is challenging in some ways. The best we can do is lay out there, first in the literature, the scientific literature, but then also get better at kind of explaining what we do and why we do it. The end result, and we've tested this, and we are correcting the data in the direction that it needs to be corrected, and the way we do this is through a battery of tests where we remove data from the record, or we artificially nudge big chunks of data one way or the other, then we see how our algorithms handle that, and we're always correcting in the right direction. How do we convince people that really don't want to be convinced? I've found that just, you know, from where we sit, we try to do our jobs. I mean, we try to get it right first. You know, that's our job. That's what you pay us to do, is get it right. So then our secondary role is help people understand that we're getting it right. We're not particularly skilled at that. But I've seen, you know, people just need a little room. They need a little space. You know, the people that are, you know, the folks that we're probably talking about, if they have a chance to get a little room, if they can step outside of their kind of ideology or maybe the things that shape their opinions, very good people, rational people. And if we can give them a little space and stop pointing the finger at them and calling them horrible people, I think we're going to make a lot of progress. I've been really, really pleasantly surprised at the progress in this particular kind of dynamic that I've seen in the last year and a half.
I think one of the things we've tried to do here in Oklahoma, and of course you heard if you were in the early session about the, the Jim Inhofe the third or whoever the governor of Oklahoma was in 25 years. But when you have a state agency like ours that is the only entity in Oklahoma that has the word climate in its name, it becomes a target. And so you have to look for common ground sometimes. So for example, with an office like Senator Inhofe's, he's a pilot. So data is incredibly important to Senator Inhofe. And so if you can find common ground about the fact that data is key to what his needs are as well as what our needs are in terms of being able to understand our atmosphere better, then that dialogue works more as a relationship. And so that's what we try to do. We try to craft relationships with those individuals over common ground rather than to always be pointing at the divisive things. And the data is key here because it underpins the fact that we don't measure the atmosphere nearly as well as we should. And so in many instances, to try and answer some of these questions, you know, for example, our upper atmospheric ability to know what's going on is 2 times per day from Radiosonde launches. That's not even remotely, our ability to do that and try and do everything from weather to climate, that's just not sufficient. So we can talk about things that we need for weather. We don't even have to mention the word climate sometimes. But in those instances, if we spend more of our time working with people about the need for data, the need for more observations, more measurements, sometimes we get better relationships and better dialogue rather than talking about, you know, the outcomes or how people have interpreted them.
All right, here we go.
Rachel Gleason, I'm a data visualization journalist with the San Antonio Express News. I have a request for Kevin, actually. Could you show us more examples of bad graphics?
And could you leave ours out?
Yeah. Wow. I guess if we went to the Facebook page, we'd probably find a bunch of them. One of the things, you know, Deke's advice here is spot on. What's the time frame that you're using? Why did you pick the start and end times that you did? Why did you pick, and now some from a graphical standpoint, what we tend to find are graphs that are not well labeled and or the labels aren't really what the data are. And so it almost has to be sort of an experiential type of thing where you see more and more and more, but it tends to be associated with axes. I was just looking at this one. I don't even know what that arrow is.
Which arrow?
The big giant purple arrow that goes through the middle.
That's the march of time.
Things like that. What have people done to the graphics that have no value from a scientific standpoint, but that draw your attention maybe somewhere else? You know, those are the kinds of things that we tend to look for. But gosh, if you'll give me your email address, I can probably send you hundreds of things that I could just send you.
You don't want to be on there. By the way, if you want another really good one, and if you want to just Google it for me, Google Jason Chaffetz, the guy running for speaker now, and Planned Parenthood graphic. This was recently. It is one of the ideal graphics because what he does is he shows a trend, but he doesn't give you axes of any kind. So that is just, you know, just you look at it and say, okay. Here we go.
Hey, Craig Miller, KQED. Deke, as you and I have spoken, stop me if you've talked about this already because I came in late, but we've talked offline about how a lot of these things are based on 30-year averages and that time frame like shifts every 10 years or something like that. So that means the standard is always shifting. And as rapidly as things are changing right now, do you risk that either understating or overstating certain trends, or how do you deal with that?
So I think the point was made really well earlier that, you know, for comparing means, 30 years is a safe assumption. It's the normals that we're talking about, these 30-year periods where we kind of call it normal and we compare the subsequent 10 years to this normal period. That concept was actually crafted before we had the concept of a rapidly changing climate. So the normals were updated to kind of capture recent trends. They're kind of not necessarily designed to, but they've served the role of helping people frame today's weather against the recent past, and in particular 30 years is about the span of someone's active professional career. So it's a good period to kind of say, during most of your adulthood or professional decision-making lifetime, this is how a particular event compares to some baseline. 30 years, though, that 30-year moving period, like you said, does not capture extremes. Extremes, you need a lot more data. To figure out what the tails of the distributions look like, you really need to gather a lot more data. There are ways to determine whether you've collected enough data to make this robust calculation, but you never really get there, to be honest. So the more data, the better. The longer period of time, we often compare things to the entire 20th century because in the United States we're lucky to have more than a century of robust data. So we often go beyond that 30-year range and compare things to behaviors that we saw throughout the 20th century.
Could I add a little bit? In some sense, what we're trying to do here, what we are doing, it's testing the strength of a signal in an environment of noise. So if there's a tight fit, a tight pattern in the data, it's pretty easy to identify it. If it is a noisy data set, then you need a much longer period of time or more observations. In this case, it's probably the same to detect that signal.
Okay, more questions? Here we go.
My name's Lou Reynolds. I'm a fisheries biologist with a federal agency. Are you taking more steps toward making better data visualizations? That's come along a great way in the last 10 years or so. Are we going to start to see that kind of stuff coming from federal agencies, just better way to show data?
Sure. We definitely are working to make the graphics connect better with people who are dropping in, if you will, trying to learn firsthand from the graphic itself about the topic. There are a number of web pages on the USGS sites that now look at things like the California drought and really illustrate the changes in reservoir contents in a geospatial manner, so that it's I won't say it's easy, but it's more intuitive than it has been in the past.
Robert, while you've got the California drought, we'll get right back to you in a second, Kevin. NASA's had a scientist who's made all sorts of news in the last year or so about the California drought, talking about within 2 years we'll be totally out of water in the reservoir. Was that really a good use? Was that misleading or not?
You asking me?
Yes, you're the water guy.
Well, yes, but I think NASA does a great job with really interesting technologies. And they applied the GRACE satellite, in that particular case, or satellite pair, to infer what the groundwater contents were. I think if there was a flaw in what they did, it was more, I get the sense they were looking at a shorter term record. Again, they haven't been up there very long. And they're trying to correlate that with the groundwater conditions. So I don't want to criticize anyone, but I think it could have been a little more robustly applied. And I think that this is one of the things about working with remote sensing, that it's often viewed as a competitor to in situ observations, when in fact we should be using them jointly. And I think that goes on, as you were saying, with the looking at temperatures. We could have done better and done more had we worked together in that particular instance.
Okay, Kevin.
Yeah, I want to get back to your visualization question. The NOAA Storm Prediction Center, for example, has done an incredible job of taking an entire database of radio sonde observations. So it's sort of in this vein of big data, and now with computer processing what it is and more streamlined, you know, the ability to create a graphic where you can look at an individual radio sonde observation, which is a weather balloon observation, and know immediately against the entire data record, this is the warmest temperature at this altitude ever, or it's the sixth warmest or whatever. And we're doing tools like that at the Climate Survey as well. We're now getting the capability from the computational side to be able to access an entire archive in real time and place today's information in the context of the past, however, you know, long that past is. And so for each forecast office in the National Weather Service, they can look at their own area and know how this particular precipitable water value, for example, compares, and if there are then analogs. So, wow, you know, the last four times we saw that value, we had floods, or seven of the last eight times we saw that value, we had supercell thunderstorms, or whatever that is. That data and that context is now being used operationally in the forecast realm, and it's through the use of those visualization tools with the ability to take today's information and put it against the entire data set. And I know the Storm Prediction Center, as well as the Weather Service offices, are making great use of that.
Okay, more questions? We'll get over here. Okay.
Hi, I'm Reese Gerholt with World Resources Institute. And I was just curious, going back to kind of what your first example, looking at the upward trends, and it really depends on just how you skew the graphic. I have challenges with that because I talk with our visual team and they ask, you know, should it be vertical, should it be horizontal, and does it mislead the viewer to make things look more extreme or not? And I'm just trying to figure out, like, at what point, is there some science behind determining when you should pick something and how upward that trend should look?
Yeah, and this is one area of our field in weather and climate that is growing greatly, the ability to communicate the information effectively. Historically, meteorologists have, can I say sucked?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Meteorologists have been very poor at actually communicating that kind of information in a way that individuals can distill it to either make a decision or, you know, whether that's in a school, you know, in terms of teaching. So we've been working heavily with communications experts and graphics experts trying to answer the question that you just posed, because it is, in fact, a challenge. And we're not well-versed in how people understand information. We sort of work in our own little research world, and here's the result. And I know Harold said it really well earlier in his session, where as a scientist, when you've done the research and you find something, you come to the realization that you're the only person on the planet that knows it. Mm-hmm. All right. Once you get to that point, how do you communicate it? And we're not real good at that. So we've solicited the help of graphics people and comms people and risk communication people, but we're not there yet.
More questions? If you don't, I have some. One tip, and somehow this came disconnected, it looks like.
I just went slight.
On the RSS data, this climate data. So one thing I never see reporters doing, and I've done it, so you should do it. It's easy enough. This is from a company called RSS. So whenever you see these climate change, people who reject mainstream climate science talk about this, call up the people at RSS and ask him about it. I did. The vice president of it is a guy named Carl Mears. He'll tell you, you cannot use this to say there is no warming. He says, if you look further out, just like Deke said, it clearly shows warming. And he will also tell you that this is just the part of the atmosphere, not what they are saying it is. And then you say, just wait, things might change. So that's something you might want to keep in mind here. So it is, you got go further to these things. The other thing I want to ask you guys is, each one of you, all these data sets are open and accessible. So isn't that one way of fighting obfuscation by saying, here is our data?
So it helps in some ways. And actually, harking back just a little bit to what Kevin was saying earlier, when we go to Congress, they really like the data part. I mean, that really does resonate with a lot of them. When we talk about interpretation, and we add interpretation because sometimes it's not enough for us just to hand the data over. Sometimes there needs to be some interpretation in order to give the data the meaning. And we try to do that in an unbiased way without picking a side of the fight and just presenting what we think is defensible science. Sometimes that doesn't sell as well in a congressional setting, for instance, particularly where there's, there's a contest over the outcome. But no, I don't think it's just enough. It is essential to do it so that the data can verify what the science is. And actually, that's what the Quality Data Control Act says, that we will put out the data from the decisions or the conclusions or the science that we've done.
So we ditto.
Actually, can you go to, and you'll see how much I use this. If you just type in NCDC, because that's the real name of your organization, that is the name of the organization until a few months ago. Okay. There, ./CAG. This is one of my favorite data websites, and this is from Deke's group. If you go on down, you can do this for your state, for your for the world. You could display trends at any time period, so you can, this is where you could see how it's easy to manipulate data just by changing display trends. So for reporters who are doing local stories, you can take this to the state level, you can take this to the city level for major cities, you could take this to the climate region level, whatever the hell those are, but every state seems to have a bunch of them. And I did this story a year ago or so, it's a wonderful story to do. You can find out where the trend is from whatever starting date you want. I tend to use 19, I use dates that end in 0 and 5 and try to make at least going back an even number or a 5 number. And you can really localize this stuff, and you can see how much, if you look at something like this, before they say the trend, this is the U.S. average temperature for September. Do you see a trend? But you'd see a different trend if you just chopped it up. So,
yeah, and I'd also add that we talked a lot about adjustments and corrections. Both the adjusted data set, the corrected data set, and the unadjusted data set are freely available. A lot of what we've learned are from scientists and frankly, the blogosphere. Kind of people that are truly interested in data will come through and examine techniques and will suggest improvements. And working with those folks has really helped us, you know, first of all, figure out to how to make the data more available instead of just kind of dumping it in an obscure part of the web. But, you know, the improvements to our processing techniques from this level of interaction, it's a healthy thing to do. It's a good thing to get criticized. I think, you know, we live in a pretty politically polarized and kind of environment, but, you know, the basis of science is criticism, and you know, we do need to get that data out there, and we do need to help colleagues criticize our work and get better.